I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, where we invite historians to commit the deadly sin of wrath. The podcast where myth and misconception has to take a vow of silence. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I am here with my loyal co-host and apostle of accuracies, Kyle Glover.
I'm not imaginative. These intros are getting worse, aren't they, people? But yes, hello everyone.
Right, well, this week, dearly beloved, we are gathered here with a stalwart of the independent company. Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome historian and author, padre of the independent company, Ian Pegg. Ian, welcome to History Rage.
Hi, both of you. How are you doing?
Doing very well, sir. Recovered from We Have very Ways Fest?
Only just. It did take me a week of much sleep and thinking. It was an interesting weekend.
It was, wasn't it? So we saw your talk out there and, you know, well done. Well done. Was that the first time that you'd gone up and done that?
It's the first time I'd done that in public. I've done a couple of podcasts, as people may be aware, previously. But to be invited to the largest World War II festival in the country and to be invited to speak about a subject that I'm really passionate about was quite overwhelming at times.
I saw you about an hour before you were due to go on, and you seriously just could not talk to anybody. Yeah.
No, it was. I think that was some of the heat as well, because yes, that was one of the hottest days I've ever experienced, having to wear a proper shirt and stand up in a greenhouse for an hour.
Okay, well, we first met back at We Have Ways Fest in September, but Kyle has been an IC member for some time now, and I've been to one or two of the IC socials as well. So for those people out there that are not part of that community, would you just give a history of you and kind of how you ended up into the field that you're in?
Right. So my history with World War II, like a lot of us, is family members. And my grandfather was a Royal Engineer in World War II. He was injured on the 23rd of May 1940, coming out of Belgium, shot in the arm, spent 8 months in hospital, was then transferred back out to Egypt and Burma and India, and spent the next 5 years before he came home again. He never really spoke about the serious side of it, but towards the end of his life, he started to open up to me particularly about his feelings and how he felt. Then there's a big gap after he died for family. And during lockdown, I found a podcast, and credit has to go to Paul Reed and the old Frontline, because it was a First World War podcast.
Yep.
Then that got me more interested in what else is out there. And I found We Have Ways. And through We Have Ways, got really into reading everything that came up, because obviously we've got nothing else to do in lockdown but read and walk. And I came across a book called Thank You, Padre, by a lady called Joan Clifford. It's a very small book, 100-odd pages long, It's little snapshots of what chaplains got up to in World War II. And the question that was always in my head is, why would a man go to war, not pick up arms, have complete belief in his faith, but put himself in danger, put himself right on the front line with the troops he served, sometimes giving up his life, sometimes giving up his freedom to ensure that the troops he served with were threat the best they can be? And once you read one book, then you want another book, then you want another book, and then you end up with a great pile of books on chaplains and the role of chaplains, and then role of chaplains and what they did, and not the spiritual side, though I have books on that, but about who they were as men. I'm fascinated in the men's story. Don't get me wrong, we love the stuff that goes whoosh and bang and dagger, 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 and we love the stories of the battles, but I want to know about the people. What makes that person do what he did, and why?
Okay, so you've come on here to do a particular rage, so are you feeling angry?
Oh, I'm starting to get wound up. I can feel it coming.
Okay, well, today then, what is the one thing that you wish everyone would just stop believing?
I think the one thing I wish everyone would stop believing about chaplains is that they only worked on Sundays. It was only about religion. People need to understand the wider role and the importance to soldiers and regiments and battalions and what they contributed in war.
Thank you. Okay, expand.
It's key to understand that they didn't just work on Sundays. It wasn't just about religion. Their role was religion and welfare. And people need to remember that. There are very few, I talked about books, there are very few books out there about their role. And people don't recognize. It's all right talking about these fantastic regiments, the 52nd Lowland, the Sherwood Rangers, the Paras, the Airborne, the SAS. What's the one factor in all of those? They all had a chaplain. They all had multiple chaplains that fought on the front line with them, that were there putting themselves in danger. These stories never get told. We get the odd chaplain. I bet everybody who listens to World War II stuff knows one chaplain, and that would be Leslie Skinner. Reverend Leslie Skinner, Sherwood Rangers, through brilliant books by James Holland and other stories. But how many other chaplains are people aware of? Very, very few. And yet their role was so vital for the spiritual, moral, and pastoral care of all soldiers, of all ranks, of all religions, no matter who they were, they could go to the chaplain. And it really, really annoys me that people think that they only worked on Sundays. They worked as hard, if not harder, than anybody else.
Where does that idea of only working on Sundays come from? It's the title of a quite famous book, as I understand.
It is the title of a quite famous book. It's the title of Reverend Leslie Skinner's book, which is, by the way, fabulous. And it's about his role in World War II. But that view of them only working on Sundays comes from pre-war. Because we all know vicars, we all know reverends. What is the view of vicars and reverends? That they only work on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
10 o'clock, you go to church. That's it. We only work on a Sunday. But nobody knows the other roles that they undertake. And it's the same in war. They do religious services. Hey, great, yeah, do a religious service on a Sunday. But what about all the other things that they get involved in? And it's a wide range of things that we're going to talk about today that I'm going to prove to people that they are the hardest working people.
Could you provide some background on the role of chaplains in the Second World War? What are their, outside of religious services, etc., what are their responsibilities and duties?
This is an interesting question to answer because at the start of the war, their guidance from their senior leaders, and they had very little training, was about the spiritual well-being of soldiers. But because very few of them had battlefield training, training in a war, they had to make themselves useful. They wanted to make themselves useful. They had to ingratiate themselves with soldiers of all ranks, be it officers, be it privates. So their roles would be spiritual, births, deaths, marriages, especially in the Phoney War. But their role is far more than that. It was about morale. It was about being an entertainment officer. It was about making sure the soldiers had some home comforts. Even in the battlefield, they would be running naffy trucks. They would be providing cigarettes. They would be providing cups of tea. It's about pastoral care. So it's about writing letters home for those soldiers that struggle to write. Some could write a formal letter. Some would write a letter with effing as every other word. And the chaplain would help them write a sensible letter. They would be involved in sporting activities. They would be involved in comfort, helping the what we now know as the mental well-being of soldiers that were struggling.
Mm-hmm.
They would be involved in writing letters home to the next of kin, writing very sensitive letters, not giving all the detail, but enough detail so that there was some comfort for those families that had died. They would be leaders of men. They were needed to lead men either at a regimental aid post or, and we'll come on to this, getting lost in the desert, getting lost in the hills. They would be seen as the leader of someone who could get them out of there. They would be working in the battlefield as medical orderlies, helping the Royal Army Medical Corps, regimental aid posts. They would be fetching wounded from the field. They would be giving morphine. They would be dressing wounds. And then there's the serious side of things. They're the ones that would be burying people and recording deaths. And that is the spiritual side, and it's meticulous recording of who died where and when and how, so that that could be put into records. It would also be about education, because in prisoners of war camps, to keep the men's morale up, they would create, there were universities created, there were schools created in prisoners of war camps, and because chaplains are educated men, they would be running courses to do with spiritual, being spiritual, but also writing English, history, whatever they could put their mind to. You can see from that, they had a wide-ranging role. There would be spies, and we'll come on to that. There would be advisors to senior officers. We could come on to that. Their role needs to be recognized for the wide-ranging impact it has across all fields. Therefore, in every battle, they were on every battlefield, every theater of war across the whole war, in the Far East, in Europe, in North Africa, in England. And I talk about army chaplains, but they were in the Navy, they were in the RAF. So it's every sort of force there.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Right then. So you've given us a lot of kind of examples there, then. Let's get into some details. So can you elaborate on some specific instances or stories that highlight the impact chaplains had on morale and well-being troops?
Yeah, I think if we start with the BEF and Dunkirk,
yeah,
there are a number of stories. For example, Reverend James Quinn is one example where in May for two or three days, he was on the beach. He was never stopped for two or three days, going around the soldiers that were trapped on the beach, making sure people were all right, helping address wounds, talking to people, soldiers who were worried, generally trying to get supplies for cigarettes and for cups of tea, helping where he can to raise morale. And he was, there's a citation, and if I remember rightly, it reads, his good nature and fortune helped those around him in their darkest time. And that recognition of somebody who was upbeat all the time, always smiling, always tried to make sure that the men around them, in pretty dire circumstances when they were on that beach, being fired upon, moving the wounded into landing ships to get them off the beach. And that's one example of how they kept that morale going. And he isn't the only one. That happened in North Africa, in Italy. There was a reverend called Wiles, I think his name was, who in North Africa ran a NAFI truck. And he would drive this on his own with his Batman, and they would go into towns to get supplies. They would purloin anything they could to ensure the troops got a little bit of lift in very dire, horrible circumstances, in weather that weren't great for an Englishman. They'd be giving tea out, they'd be giving cigarettes out, they'd be giving whatever food they could find out. And generally, it's a place where they could come and gather, where then if the soldiers wanted to, they could speak to the chaplain about how they were feeling, whether they were worried. He could deal with that moral and spiritual side at the same time.
I know one, you mentioned there that we all know one chaplain, which was Leslie Skinner. Although I can't immediately name him, don't quote me on this, I think it's John Gwinnett, who is the Nine Para chaplain. Didn't he kind of leave the pennant on the tree at Chateau Saint-Côme and say, if you're going to retreat from here, you're going to have to take this with you, which is something that, morale-wise, it keeps those soldiers at that what could have been a last stand.
Yeah, very much so. And I don't know what we have to remember is there were 3,692 chaplains in the British Army, the Royal Army chaplains. They were to serve, how many men served? How many millions were there?
Good Lord, you don't want to count, do you?
Yeah, exactly. And each chaplain had a responsibility for 1,200 men in a regiment or a battalion. And it's stories like that the men around them, soldiers around him, would have looked up to say, actually, he stood there with his chin out saying, right, come on, let's do this, let's get on. And he isn't the only one in North Africa. Decided to hold the service. It wasn't on Sunday, but he felt the men needed spiritual need on this particular day in battle. He stood up to speak in this makeshift church as shells were going off around him. Everybody else dove for cover. He just carried on with his service. The morale that gave the men to be brave, to see that this chaplain wasn't going to bow down to the Germans no matter what they were throwing at him, really lifted the company. And that was mentioned in the battalion diary later in the war, that one moment of morale lifting. The fact that actually when they interviewed him in the newspaper after the war, he said he was so scared he'd forgotten to dive is a minor issue. He just carried on doing the thing he remembered. But that gave that boost to all those people around.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It slots neatly into our next question. In addition to the spiritual, the direct religious aspect, chaplains often served as counselors and advisors. How did their guidance help soldiers navigate the very complex dilemmas and challenges of the war?
I think that, first of all, we have to remember that it's a dilemma for a chaplain to be at war. So his first dilemma is with himself and his own religion, because it's religion generally is about not taking life.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to square that about with themselves. But then we have to remember that the chaplains were there not to judge people for being at war, but to support people in their hour of need, to support the soldiers in their hour of need. And they were advisors to everybody from colonels, lieutenants, all the way down to privates. So they would be advising majors. There's one major, and I do apologize, I can't remember his name, who ended up leading a regiment because all the senior officers had been killed. He turned to the chaplain for advice because he wanted to make sure he was doing the right thing for his men, morally and spiritually, making sure that they were in the right place, that he wasn't endangering them unnecessarily, and wanted someone's advice on whether that was happening. And then you would get the privates in their trenches, in their dugouts, in their shell holes, who were scared that they'd never see their families ever again. And he would be listening to their worries, sharing a cigarette with them, sharing a cup of tea with them. And that's the thing we have to remember. Not only were they there as chaplains, they were friends. They were there as a friend to everyone. So they would be, as much as anything, listening. They didn't really have to talk. People need someone to be there to listen to. And chaplain's role was to listen, to comfort, to hopefully give some comfort in when people are worried. And then you get the side of things where you get a chaplain. So the 5th of June, 1944, airborne, getting ready to board their gliders. And Reverend George Parry was taken aside by one of the majors in the parachute regiment. And the major said to him, "I don't think I am going to survive this battle. I am really worried." And George Parry, in a very private ceremony with very few paras around, held a religious service, listened to him, and blessed him under the wing of a glider before they climbed aboard to head towards the Orne Bridge and the landing that took place there. That has to give people some comfort, the fact that they are being listened to, and apparently that service was very moving in terms of the things that Parry actually said.
What do we know of the things that Parry said?
It was reported by one of the other people there that it was just very moving. It doesn't actually say what his actual words were.
Yeah.
It was just that it was comfort to those around. It was a very private ceremony in the dark, under the wing of a glider. And I think for me, just reading that felt very moving in terms of that action that took place then.
Mm. Yeah, and there is a guy, I suppose, we don't know what he said, but from what we can see of what happened following it, he said exactly what needed to be said at the time.
Yeah, very, very much so. Very much so.
You mentioned that these guys are advising everybody from, like, colonels through down, majors, lieutenants, all the way down to privates. I'll confess, because, you know, it's a time of confessions, I haven't looked as much at chaplains. In fact, I've probably looked at chaplains as much as everybody else has, really.
And that's,
apart from you.
That's my rage. That's the
yes,
rage.
Yes, exactly.
People there don't recognise what they've done, their role in the war. And it's people like that making comments. I haven't looked. Well, I'm going to tell you about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you know what their role was.
So in terms of rank structures, where are these guys fitting in?
So they are fitting in as officers. So mm-hmm. The lowest ranked chaplain would be a fourth class chaplain classed as a captain. Mm-hmm. But that would be they would be billeted in officers' ranks, messes, but that was as far as it went. They didn't have any direct leadership. Because they were there for all men, their important thing was to ingratiate themselves with any level of soldier, from the private right up. There were four classes, fourth class, third class, second class, and first class. First class is the chaplain general, top board, and he would be of rank of colonel. Then it would be second class lieutenant colonel, third class is a major, and fourth class is a captain. And in terms of promotion, very rare. Because there were 3,692, most chaplains, and I don't know the figures, would be captain, fourth class, or get to third class. Because once you're getting up into second class and first class, you are at the level of one or two of you, basically.
Yeah, it's like the army equivalent of a bishop.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. So serving as a chaplain during a world war then comes with its own set of challenges and sacrifices. Can you share some of the hardships, personal sacrifices, areas of courage that chaplains faced while on the front lines?
I think in terms of sacrifice, it's that their sacrifice was, and this sounds very trivial, is giving up their comfortable life in a church or a parish in some corner of England where they would be responsible for a little village or a church, and they would be plunged into a world that they wouldn't be used to.
Mm-hmm.
A world of bawdy men who every other word would be effing this and effing that in some instances. And some of these chaplains were very protected. They'd come from private schools. They'd not really experienced the rougher side of society. It's a very trivial thing, but in actually that change from being very protected to being in that environment is a massive change. Those that were married, like all soldiers, gave up their families because they went to war, and the chaplains, especially the however many were captured at Dunkirk, 30 plus that were captured at Dunkirk, a lot of those were prisoners of war for the whole length of the war. They might get one letter home every couple of months, their letters to them from their families when they were eventually found that they were prisoners of war. They might not got any letters for 6 months, and then they might come in a bundle. So they were isolated from their families and from society, and that must have been very, very hard. Though they could give moral and spiritual guidance to the prisoners of war that were around them, they lost all their freedom, as everybody did who was a prisoner of war, and they lost their contact with home, as everybody did who was a prisoner of war. In some instances, they gave up their life. There is one chaplain in the parachute regiment, and I want to say his name is Egan. Nope, Benson. He was a Roman Catholic priest who was injured at Arn. He had an injury to his arm. He had to have his arm amputated. And he believed, because of that injury, that he could not fulfill his duties as a Roman Catholic priest. And from what I have read, he basically gave up the will to live at that point, even though he could have survived with the injuries. And actually, he could have served as a Roman Catholic priest. But his belief that he couldn't meant that he sacrificed his life. He sacrificed his life.
Thank you. So you mentioned a few guys that kind of go into the camps. I'm led to believe some voluntarily, some, you know, are captured. But typically, if these guys are all officers, then they're going to end up in officers' camps, in oflags. But there's a whole wealth of people that need spiritual and pastoral support in the stalags as well. And do you guys end up in those?
The prison of war for chaplains is a really interesting point of view, because as a non-combatant under the Geneva Convention, technically they could not be prisoners of war, even though they were. Mm. They were held as prisoners of war. Some of them were given a little more freedom than just being in one camp. Where camps did not have a chaplain, they would be allowed to travel between camps to undertake their religious duties.
Really?
Yes. It was different in the Far East, and we can talk about prisoners of war in the Far East. That is a whole different subject about how chaplains suffered there. But in Europe, as prisoners of war, they would be there mainly for spiritual and keeping morale up, and keeping their own morale up, because they would have the men. They would travel between camps. The problem with them traveling between camps, because they wanted to continue the war effort, they would also be transferring information between camps. They would be bringing information back as spies. There is one chaplain that traveled between camps with an SS officer with parts of a radio in his vestments bag, actually in the SS officer's car, which must have been quite a hairy journey.
You'd do a lot of praying there, wouldn't you?
They did a lot of praying. They were kept in all camps, including Colditz. So there were at least six Royal Army chaplains retained in Colditz. What I haven't worked out is why. Because in at least three of their cases, they'd not attempted to escape from previous prisoners of war camp. They just happened to end up in Colditz. And that is very much, they weren't allowed to travel outside of Colditz. Colditz was very much a closed prisoners of war camp.
But unless you're an inmate, of course, in which case everybody did their level best to walk out the gate.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
But more often than not the chaplains. Mm. One or two of them did, but the rest of them, their view was, whilst ever there is men that have their privilege taken away as prisoner of war, we will be here to help them and serve.
And you mentioned that the Far East is a completely different kettle of fish, as it were, there with regards to how chaplains work and what chaplains suffer. So would you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Far East, and this is the difference between Germany recognizing some part of the Geneva Convention and understanding religion and what the role of a chaplain was, and the Japanese being very suspicious of chaplains. So in some camps, they weren't allowed to pray. Their religious festivals were not recognized, which means they were done underground. No Easter, no Christmas. They were given the same punishment as everybody else. The difference with the Japanese, and for example, in Changi camp, where there were 40,000 prisoners of war went through the camp, there was 127 chaplains in Changi. There were a number of churches built around those chaplains. They would have their own church where they would deliver their religious services, but those churches were more than that. They were the center of the community of that particular part. But the Japanese were very distrustful of chaplains. They wouldn't give them hymn sheets, they wouldn't give them Bibles. A lot of what they talked about and sang and the hymns was done from memory, were written down rather than them being given sheets. But where it becomes even worse is, so we've got Reverend Herbert Davis, who was taken prisoner in December 41, and he was a prisoner of war in the Shamshipo camp. And he refused to bow down to the Japanese, so that every service on a Sunday at the end, he would stand up on his own and he would sing the national anthem. And he was flogged every Sunday for over 12 months for doing that. And he never gave up. He would not bow. And the Japanese thought he was being disrespectful to them and to his religion. But he saw it as his way of fighting. And the Japanese were very suspicious of all chaplains. They did not give them the respect that they deserved. They just treat them as normal soldiers.
Yeah.
Were there any recognition or awards given to chaplains for their service in the war?
Yes, lots. Well, lots. There was only one Victoria Cross given to a chaplain.
Ooh, tell us about him.
That Victoria Cross was Canadian Army chaplain, John Weir Foote. John Weir Foote was the only chaplain in the war to be awarded a Victoria Cross. He was attached to the Royal Hamilton Life Infantry, a Canadian Army chaplain, at Operation Jubilee, Dieppe Raid, 19th of August 1942. After he landed, he was assisting the medical officer in caring for the wounded. Recognising they were wounded on the open beach, throughout the 6 or 7 hours, he would run across the open beach under fire, giving morphine to the wounded, bringing them back to the medical aid post, and generally putting his life at risk to rescue as many wounded as he could. The second part of this is that they used a landing ship as their regimental aid post. It was hit by a shell and the ammunition set on fire. So he carried all the wounded off the landing ship. He took his boots off because it was easier to carry them. He carried wounded onto landing ships to get them away, and he had an opportunity to escape himself. He could have got off that beach, but he didn't. Recognizing there were going to be how many thousands captured as prisoner of war, he gave up his freedom. And that's important to recognize. And what's really important is nobody knew who he was. After, there were stories of this Padre X, anonymous Padre, who'd done heroic feats, who'd really raised morale by running and helping wounded. And it wasn't until weeks later that he was identified. Now, he, and that was in August 42, was then a prisoner of war till 1945, where he was liberated from Bremen. He endured significant hardships at prisoners of war camps, remembering he had no boots. The first 2 days, he walked 30 miles with no boots, with just bare feet, which caused him massive problems.
Mm.
And he continued to help the soldiers as prisoners of war, raising morale, serving them spiritually. He was awarded a Victoria Cross, the only chaplain to be awarded a Victoria Cross, which amazes me, because you talk about some of the other stories of MCs that were awarded. So, for example, Reverend George Hales, who is another Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry chaplain that not much is known about.
Mm.
Tunisia, 1942, a number of times he re-entered a minefield to rescue wounded from a blown-up tank. Not once, a number of times, putting himself at risk to go and rescue wounded whilst still under fire. And I think his citation reads about his calmness in that situation, keeping everybody calm whilst he did what he needed to do. He got an MC for that. There was an immediate MC awarded for his action in that minefield. The number of chaplains that were awarded MCs, MBEs, OBEs, and it's for very simple things. So the Reverend Jeff Treglowan, battle school in Northampton, before he even got out there, 1944, towards the February 44, he was at battle school. They were doing under fire training, crawling through ditches. A stick of gelignite fell into the ditch where he was. Recognizing he could seriously injure everybody around him, he picked it up and threw it away. As it threw away, it blew his hand off. He was awarded an MBE for that bravery, because he was the only person to be injured in that action, where it could have injured everybody around him. Quick thinking, no concern for his own safety. I'm going to save everybody that's around me. And you have to really recognise that in terms of what's happening. You get OBEs, Padre Harold Key, May 1940, on the beach, under fire, kept morale up by bringing round cigarettes, mail, being there for the men, making sure the men had got everything they needed, gathering troops from regiments together, just generally on the go all the time. And that was recognised by him receiving an OBE when he got back to the UK. So they were awarded, apart from the one VC, numerous MCs, DSOs, every sort of citation you can think of. It amazes me that only one got a Victoria Cross. For some of the actions, there are so many stories of chaplains doing things that to me are beyond brave, are heroes, and yet they didn't win that highest award, putting themselves in danger.
Okay, so in light of this often overlooked role, what do you believe should be done to ensure that the contributions of chaplains in World War II and other conflicts are remembered and appreciated for generations to come?
Well, the first thing that we must all do is recognise these stories. And part of why I undertake this research, well, every reason I undertake this research is to get the stories of these men out there. As I said at the beginning, it's not about spirit. This is about them as individuals, as men. What makes them the hero that they are? What makes them as brave as they are? And how do we tell those stories? Well, I'm going to tell those stories in my book that will be out in May 2024 called Death and Heroes, Army Chaplains in World War II. I got my plug in there. But
yep,
what's really important is there is a fantastic Royal Army Chaplains Museum at Shrivenham. That is a must visit. That tells their story. That is a brilliant place to go and see what army chaplains did. But we must do more than that. We must continue to recognise chaplains' role in all conflicts. In the First World War, three chaplains got Victoria Crosses. One of those chaplains was one of the most decorated soldiers in the First World War. His story isn't very well told. There were chaplains in the Korean War. There were chaplains at the Falklands. The story of them on the front line with their battalions, with their regiments, the role that they undertook, not just religion, as we have discussed, has to continue to be highlighted. They are an integral part of the military, a part that everybody values. Everybody remembers, all soldiers remember their chaplain. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. But they remember their chaplain. Now, don't get me wrong. They weren't perfect. They weren't all heroes. There were chaplains, as with all soldiers, that were not suited to military life. Mm-hmm. There were chaplains that were dismissed for insubordination. There were chaplains that were dismissed for inappropriate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
There were chaplains that were dismissed for inappropriation of goods.
They are human.
They are human. They are absolutely human. But the majority of them that served on the front line, right on the front line, rescuing the wounded, being there under fire, not flinching. That's the story that we have to tell. 3,692 of them. 96 gave up their lives in World War II. 38 Commonwealth chaplains gave up their lives in World War II for the men that they served with, either through injuries received in battle or died in battle. And that's really important. We need to continue. We talk about all the other brilliant regiments, but we need to raise their profile.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. That was an epic eye-opener into, as you say, a regiment, a group that's everywhere and yet is nowhere in the history books. And you're going to change that.
I am going to change that. I think it's really important to continue to tell these stories. It's important to recognise who these men were. They were from your community. They were from every community in this country, every community in Scotland, every community in Wales, every community in Ireland. We mustn't forget that.
Mm-hmm.
They all served on the front line. They all did their bit and their story has to be told.
Well, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to know more about this subject, then you should keep a close eye out for Ian's upcoming book on the subject, and we will be sharing out how to get that when it launches. You can connect with Ian directly through the Independent Company online socials, and of course, you can follow him on Twitter at ClueLessPeg. Well, once again, Ian, thank you very much for coming on History Rage. Do you feel better?
I feel like I have sold my soul to the world and raised my spirits immensely by telling these stories. A relief it is.
Amen to that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I do hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage or individually, I am at Paul Baffle.
And I am at Kyle G History.
And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to book questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.